ladies and gentlemen, and fellow golfers, for your entertainment.
It's the Golf to Go Hour with Frank LaRosa, brought to you by the Hagen Oaks Golf Super Shop, America's most awarded golf facility. Naturewood Home Furnishings, where it's all about choices and always about quality.
Welcome into the Golf to Go Radio Hour here on Sacktown Sports 1140. Hello, I'm Frank LaRosa with you every week with Talk About Golf. He's Scott Marsh. Scott, how you doing today?
I'm doing great. Looking forward to this hour, another half hour of great guests.
We do have some pretty good guests, as we try to do every week. As we say over and over again, this is a game. It's supposed to be fun. You know, so many people just, golf is a game that nobody can ever master. I mean, if you shoot a 59 like Al Geiberger did for the first time, everybody wants to shoot 58. I mean, it's that kind of a game. There's no limit to... I suppose 18 would be the limit, you know.
It's all relative to where you're at. That's what makes it so much fun, because I think regardless of what level you play at, you always want to improve.
Exactly. Talking about playing, we are our first guest today. Jason Scott Deegan has played a lot of golf, 1,100 courses in 22 countries around the world. And, on the face of it, it sounds like a lot of fun, but there's some work to be done after as well.
I'll take on that work any day, Frank.
All right, I'll tell Jason you're ready for that. Tom Morton from Hagen Oaks, director of player development, will be with us. And Tom always shines the light on something that we think we knew, but we didn't really know.
He's the expert. He's the guru in golf training for sure.
Jim Cowan is the chief governance officer for the Northern California Golf Association. He wrote a story in the last magazine about playing shorter tees and having that be more fun. And I would tend to agree with him. We're going to find out what he means by that.
Look forward to hearing his thoughts.
All that and more on this edition of the Golf to Go Radio Hour here on Sacktown Sports 1140. We'll be back with Mr. Deegan right after this.
It's the Golf to Go Hour with Frank LaRosa on Sacktown Sports.
Welcome back into the Golf to Go Radio Hour here on Sacktown Sports 1140. Hi, I'm Frank LaRosa. My buddy Scott Marsh is there. And we've got a guest, a friend I've known for a number of years, Jason Scott Deegan. Jason is the managing editor of Golf Pass, which is affiliated with NBC Sports Next. And Jason claims, and I would tend to believe him, he's played 1,000+ courses in relatively short career in golf in over 22 countries. Jason, how you doing? And are you tired from all that playing?
You know, as I age, the trips get tougher, but, it's hard to complain when, you're going to Australia, you're going to Tasmania, and you're tired from jet lag, but you're just thrilled to be there. So spirits are high and life is good.
You know, I like the way you describe that, because whenever somebody finds out that I've been somewhere or, done some trip, and certainly I don't travel as much as you do, but they forget the fact that when we come back, there's a lot of work to be done. There is fun while you're there, but, you may be even working in your hotel room at night to get your stuff ready for publication when you come back. So how do you tend to balance the work and pleasure part of it?
Yeah, that's definitely the biggest challenge of the job, and it's especially in today's social media age where, that just added another element to the job that wasn't here a decade ago. So you try to play a course or have a good interview, then you have to send something out right away on social, got to be creative and, have a little attitude with your message. So you're kind of always on. So it's definitely not a vacation. And I think that's what people miss about what we're doing is, we're working, we're always on, we're always looking for the best photo, the best interview. But yeah, when you're working in great places like golf takes you, it's all still great.
You've been with us on the show before, and you and I have talked in the past couple of months about getting you back on, and your schedule has just been crazy this year. Where's the latest place you've been?
Well, so probably 2 weeks ago, I was in Palm Springs, and that's not too far of a trip for me. I'm in San Jose, direct flight. But the exciting part about that is there's a new resort there. One of the most high-end exclusive places I've ever been, the Sensei Porcupine Creek. And, you know, this is Larry Ellison's pet project. He bought a mansion, turned it into a wellness resort. The mansion just happened to have a golf course in the backyard, and it's just spectacular. I mean, it's a really cool place, but obviously that comes with a price tag.
You know, it's interesting. There, it must be pretty exclusive because this is the first I've heard about this resort.
Yeah, it definitely is. You know, hold your breath when I tell you the tea time costs $1,000. So, you know, they're keeping it exclusive by pricing most people out of the, you know, staying there. But it's a great resort. It's very intimate. It's actually right in Rancho Mirage. You would drive by and never know it was there because it's hidden kind of up in a neighborhood. And, you know, it's just, again, really cool. I'm imagining LA celebrities just pop in for the weekend. And, you know, it's a real California retreat for people lucky enough to get in the gates.
That's great. I was just down in Palm Springs and played a couple of golf courses myself, but I'm going to have to talk to Mr. Ellison about banging on his gate someday. You've been to Australia lately too. Am I getting that right?
Yeah. So, you know, that anchored the early part of my year. I was in Australia and Tasmania for 16 days. And I mean, as golf trips go, that's the bucket list of all bucket lists. I mean, I can probably honestly say that's the best trip I've ever taken. Between the golf courses and the culture and the food and the scenery. I mean, it's just an incredible place down under.
You've been to some fabulous places, not unlike the resort you just talked about. So that's pretty high praise to say that this is the best golf trip you've ever been on. What distinguished it?
I just think the uniqueness of the destinations I went to. You know, I went to three different places, so obviously, not everybody's willing to go on vacation and hop from plane to plane. But when you're down under, you kind of just have to take advantage of being in that neck of the world and, you know, acclimatizing to the change of time and the culture. So, you know, Melbourne's an incredible city. And then you go to Tasmania, which is just this wild world of nature and beauty and kind of rural countryside. There's the famous Barn Boogle Resort down there. And then you go to the most maybe remote golf island in the world, King Island. And there's just two incredible courses right on the ocean, Ocean Dunes and Cape Wickham. So between the three places you visit, it's just endless variety of golf and just really interesting places.
I don't know, Scott, this is sounding pretty good to me, huh?
I have become very jealous just listening to the interview so far, and I haven't even asked the question yet. Jason, a couple of things I have. I know you're kind of famous for your golf ball rack and just all the locations you've been with the logoed golf balls. I want to know what gets on the rack, because I know you're running out of space. It's like a wine rack for golf balls. So talk about how you put that together and what qualifies now on your extensive list of golf courses.
Yeah, so, you know, the competition now is officially fierce. I feel bad, like I'm bumping off some courses that most people would consider the best courses they've ever played. You know, the rack holds about 600 golf balls. So I've played about 1,100 courses in my career. So 500 golf courses aren't even making the list. And, you know, so it's just, it's fun to play around, and every time you look at a logo ball, you think, oh, I remember that course. I remember that round. I remember who I played with. So it's a real great just kind of souvenir to keep the memories alive.
No, it looks awesome. Now, I've got to ask you, too, because I know you recently tweeted out about LA Country Club, which is hosting the U.S. Open. Unfortunately, I'm going to be going to that event in June. And it's obviously a real prestigious country club area. What should I look for at that course, you know, in terms of watching the Open?
I think it's just like Augusta National, where the TV images you see in the photos I tweeted out don't do justice to just the land movement. The elevation change on some of those holes is pretty incredible. And the fact that the LA skyline is just kind of hanging over the golf course, you know, and then I tweeted out this morning that Lionel Richie is this very nice place right on the fourth hole, and the Playboy Mansion is nearby. So LA is just an incredible spot for a major championship. They haven't had one since 1995, which was at Riviera, and haven't had a U.S. Open in 75 years there. So the city is just excited and ripe for a really cool event.
Yeah, it sounds like it's going to be a great location for it, no doubt.
Yeah, I think the golf course is it's kind of a mystery. You know, people are curious how the pros are going to play it, what they're going to shoot, you know, because it's just never been on this stage before. The site is so compact, they had to limit how many tickets they could sell. So, you know, it's just going to be kind of a real intrigue to turn on the TV and watch that event unfold.
Yeah.
Jason, you mentioned your career, and I think back to the first time we met, which has to be 20 plus years ago, and you were not too far along in your career. You were, I think at that point you were writing for a newspaper in Michigan, maybe, where you're from. And so when you think about all the time since then and all the places you've traveled, you didn't expect, as a matter of fact, you took up the game late, so you didn't really expect golf writing to be your career.
No, I mean, I tell people I'm so blessed to just the opportunities that have kind of fallen in my lap. Obviously some hard work as well to get here, but yeah, I was a sports writer in Michigan, just covering all sports, and got a lucky phone call that said, hey, can you can you review some golf courses for us? And that just kind of opened my eyes to, oh my goodness, people actually get paid to play golf, photograph golf courses, you know, analyze their holes. And that just kind of stoked a passion in me, and I just started chasing it. And, you know, it took me a decade to get entrenched. So again, a lot of hard work, a couple breaks along the way, but hired in Golf Channel in 2011, and just kind of taking things from there.
You talk about golf in Michigan and golf in California. Those are two of the most incredible states with beautiful golf courses. What's the difference, or is there one, in golf in Michigan as opposed to California?
I think like anything else, it's just the value. You know, in California, kind of a mediocre course will cost you $75 to $100, where in Michigan, you can have a really good golf course for $50. You know, Michigan has the most public courses in the country with right around 800. So the competition is really fierce to get golfers to visit any golf course. So that holds the pricing down. And, you know, the land is so beautiful in Michigan. People don't realize the nice rolling hills you have up in northern Michigan. It's a really great vacation spot in the summer. So, you know, there's just so many good golf courses.
So for Northern California golfers, which most of our audience will be, and you're a Northern California guy at this point, give us some undiscovered little secrets that you know, there's some golf courses that maybe are not on our radar in Northern California or even in Southern California, I suppose, in the state that we probably should find a way to go play someday.
Yeah, I mean, in Southern California, you kind of have Sol Park and you have Rustic Canyon. Those are kind of like an hour north of L.A., kind of away from the hustle and bustle of the city. So they have really nice, you know, settings up in the canyons. And, you know, not really overcrowded with homes and decently priced golf. So those are two pretty close by to each other. Actually, you could do 36 holes in a day, but definitely make a weekend out of it. And then up here, you know, I'm really fortunate to live across the street from what I consider one of the better munis in the Bay Area, Santa Teresa Golf Club. There's 18 holes plus a 9-hole short course. The place is always bumping with junior golfers. So it has a really nice vibe to it. So, you know, when I want a Twilight Nine, or to fix something in my game, I can just walk over there and have a good time. And everybody's really friendly in the facility. So I feel like that's kind of my home club. And I'm perfectly proud to say that, you know, I'm not a member of some exclusive place. I'm a Muni golfer just like the rest of you.
When you think about California, you know, when you were talking about the courses, we've got certainly mountain golf in Reno, Tahoe area. We've got the ocean golf, the Monterey Peninsula, and we've got the desert golf. In addition to all what I suppose you'd describe as parkland golf up and down the state. So we really have just about every kind of golf imaginable right here in California.
Yeah, and I think that's the biggest selling point. You know, Californians don't have to leave the state to find a great vacation. You know, if I want to leave the city, I can go down to the desert. If I want to, you know, escape to the mountains and Lake Tahoe, you know, that's just a 4-hour drive away from me. So, yeah, the variety is so cool. And then, you know, between the number of different architects you have here, famous and not so famous, historic and modern. And then, like you say, all those different settings. That's why a lot of people believe California is the best state for golf. You know, Oregon gives them a run. Wisconsin is making a move. Florida has a lot of golf courses. So there's a lot of competition at the top, but you could easily argue California is number one.
So where would be the, if you had, let's say a modest budget, and you and a group wanted to get away for 3 or 4 days of golf, give us your choice in California.
Ooh, that's a tricky one. You know, yes. I think you can go to any destination for a modest price. Like, you know, the golf on the peninsula, Monterey Peninsula is expensive, but you don't have to play Pebble Beach to have a great weekend. You can go to Pacific Grove. You can go to Bayonet and Black Horse, two really good golf courses. I really like, you know, Carmel Valley Ranch is a short and interesting Pete Dye golf course. So, yeah, there's four golf courses right there. That's a weekend for you. And you can probably do the same thing in Tahoe. You know, you might have to do some afternoon twilight type tee times because the golf is a little expensive up in the mountains. But it's so beautiful that I would say it's totally worth it.
With 1,100 golf courses played, do you have a favorite?
Well, so it's good that you asked that question because my answer has changed after all these years. That trip to Australia and Tasmania opened my eyes to Cape Wickham, and that's the golf course on King Island that I was talking about. It's just the most incredible mix of scenery and value and, you know, strategic golf. It's like Lynx because it's windy site, but there's this beautiful lighthouse overlooking the golf course. And, you know, if I close my eyes and envision where I want to be playing, those are the sights that I see. It's just too cool.
We have to find a way to carry his bag, I guess, huh, Scott?
I'd love to be his caddy, no doubt. Jason, just curious, what's your favorite all-time photo? Do you have one? Is that an unfair question?
Oh, man, that's a tricky one for sure. I have a really special memory at Turnberry in Scotland. I made a hole-in-one there. The night before, I stayed in the Tom Watson suite, so I feel like I channeled some Tom Watson on that shot. So just the photo of me with my hole-in-one ball and my buddy Mike Hiller, who's another golf writer from Texas, we shared that experience. Wow. That's a good, great personal memory, but, you know, there's so many great golf photos because I've been lucky enough to play so many great courses, Turnberry and Kauri Cliffs and Cape Kidnappers in New Zealand and this Cape Wickham. That photo gallery is going to publish here in another week or so. So I'm really proud. I work extra hard to get good photos. I get up early. I stay on the course late. So that's definitely a passion of mine.
No, that's fantastic. And Jason, I don't know how many hole-in-ones you have, but, you know, Frank has three, as he tells me often when we play. So,
yes, you know, I have two. So I make sure that I slide that in when, especially after I make a snowman, you know, I kind of bring that up.
Well, collectively, you have five more than me combined, guys. So
Yeah, between the three of us, we have five. That's right. Mine wasn't at Turnberry, though. Jason Scott Deegan, he's the managing editor of Golf Pass. Always a treat to have you on the show, and I look forward to having you back. You know, the great part about golf is that there are still, with 1,100 courses played, there are still undiscovered golf courses that you don't know about even. And so I look forward to the next time you come back and tell us where you've been.
I appreciate you guys having me on. Thanks so much.
This is the Golf to Go Radio Hour on Sactown Sports 1140.
It's the Golf to Go Hour with Frank LaRosa on Sactown Sports.
Welcome back in to the Golf to Go Radio Hour here on Sactown Sports 1140. Great friend of the show. We like having back every now and then, Tom Morton. He's the not only a vice president of Morton Golf, but he is the director of coaching and development at the Hagen Oaks Golf Complex. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Always a pleasure. Well, I don't know about you, Scott. I always learn something when we have Tom. I mean, I've been around, you know, I've gone to a number of the NCPGA teaching and coaching seminars over the years and have listened to all of the great coaches. When we have Tom on the show, I always learn something that either I've forgotten or it's something that I never thought about. So it's always a pleasure, Tom. You know, as we get out of the rainy season and begin to move into, you know, what traditionally is called the golf season, I guess, is there something that we should be now thinking about or maybe taking care of in terms of exercise, or, you know, what do we do in this transition period to get ready for the rest of the golf season?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, golf courses certainly are transitioning, especially this year with what has been this winter. You know, we really begin to transition from needing to keep the ball a little bit more in the air to now really looking at trajectory as a whole and oftentimes around the green, learning and wanting to play it on the ground a bit more and, you know, rolling the ball up to some greens or, you know, using the maybe a little less loft around the greens. And so the trajectory control certainly begins to change this time of year, and just being, I think, more open-minded to the options that exist when you get probably within, 50 yards or so of the green.
You know, it's interesting when you're talking about that, what through my mind was, a mishit, and a mishit, you know, will tend to roll. And in this time of year, that's a good thing. You know, we kind of get a little down on ourselves because we didn't hit the shot we wanted. But sometimes that's the way we probably should have played the shot in the first place. And it can have good results. I'm not suggesting that we have mishits, but in terms of controlling the trajectory, that's probably more the trajectory we want. But we want to have it with a better ball striking, I'm guessing.
Yeah, and you know, I'm guessing also that's where the expression thin to win came from.
Yeah.
I don't recall hearing anything, an expression that has to do with fat and good connected to one another. So
Scott, when you get around the greens, you know, as we've talked about before, you hit the ball a long way and, maybe around the greens. Of course, lately you've been chipping with your hybrid, which, Tom, I don't know that we've ever talked about that, but Scott has certainly kind of steadied his game around the greens by using the hybrid, to get out of the rough or the longer grass around the greens and get it up on the green.
Yeah, I mean, with the wide sole that exists on a hybrid, it really is becomes about chunk proof. And it, you know, glides through the turf really easily and certainly lower loft than a wedge. And, you know, especially those players, I think more players getting fitted means they have hybrids in the bag. And, you know, a lot of times hybrids even starting at the 6 or 7 iron. And so there's a reasonable amount of loft there. And I think it's not a bad play oftentimes to do that and just sort of make a little putting type stroke and bump it on up there. Far less can go wrong.
Been working for you, Scott.
Well, that's my process because my chipping and pitching is by far the worst part of my game. And Tom, as you know, I've talked to you about, you know, because Hagen Oaks has the great learning facility with the practice holes on the backside and just going up there and taking advantage of that. But maybe you could help explain, because on the pitch and chip, my biggest error I make is I must open my club as I'm trying to chip, and I have the ball for, since I'm a left-handed golfer, we'll head left. For a right-handed golfer, it would go right. Maybe you could offer some thoughts or suggestions on that.
It's certainly club face could absolutely be a big part of it. I mean, club face, as I think we've mentioned on the show, is the master ruler of where the ball ultimately wants to go. So having good club face control, both not only open and closed club face, but also, you know, adding loft and de-lofting really is, you know, important to be able to control our golf ball as well. But also the angle of approach or attack that we have down on the golf ball, whether it's a little more shallow or steep, really impacts how we strike it and what turf conditions we happen to be in. And then, you know, what we want the ball to do ultimately, whether to, you know, go a little higher, run a little bit more, and so on and so forth. So, you know, really club face and then angle of attack are two really key components to figure out what the ball is going to do.
You know, the phrase using the ground more, you know, I've heard instructors use that. And basically, I think what they're saying is that we're not taking a divot, or we get around the greens and we get a little, you know, a little nervous about hitting it too hard. So we try to help the ball, but actually hitting the ground is probably more important than being lighter with the club face.
Definitely. And in a practice swing, what you really want to be doing is engaging the turf. And that doesn't mean just like the tops of the grass. You know, you get people that are sweeping the tops of the grass, but ball doesn't sit directly on top of the grass. It sits, you know, a little bit below and oftentimes on the ground. So you have to engage the turf on the ground and hear that sole of that club thumping the, you know, the ground that the grass is growing out of ultimately. And, you know, really in those practice swings getting ready for the shot, you should be feeling that tempo and that engagement of the turf. And, you know, that really should be the focus, because once you've decided what type of shot you're going to hit in the club you have, that sort of is done. And so you really get the feel of what, how you want that club to land is important.
I mentioned in the introduction that you are vice president of Morton Golf, but you're also president of the Morton Golf Foundation. I think people would be surprised to know that that you're also in the business of giving. Tell us a little bit about the foundation and what you got going right now.
Yeah, we're very proud of that. And it's, as you know, guys, it's not something that we, you know, run around publicizing. It's just something that we feel like is the right thing to do for our community and the game as a whole. And so, you know, we've given, you know, well over $1 million back into the community since the inception of the foundation. And we do multiple things. There's around 15 different charities that we support. We aren't a program running foundation. We're a fund development foundation that uses the game to help the underserved and the different parts of the communities, whether veterans or Special Olympics or, you know, you name it, we're there to help. And so other foundations that use the game to help those segments of our community, we help fund many of their programs, as well as we give out college scholarships every year to those that are connected to the game. They don't actually have to be great golfers. It's really, are they connected to the game, whether they work at a course or, you know, they've been through a program and so on and so forth. And then we also give junior golf grants out and to help those that are playing the game and hoping they aspire to get better, whether it's helping to fund them be in a program or helping to fund a tournament they need to go to because they can't do it themselves. We're in the business of doing that. And then lastly, a big thing that we've just started to undertake and we're breaking ground, has actually begun, is we raised money and we were building a little golf facility, a green and a bunker, and it's all artificial turf and a little hitting area on the campus of Hiram Johnson High School. And not only is it going to be used by the high school, but actually the area schools and the community are going to get to see the game of golf without having to get to a golf course. They literally just walk or ride their bike. And then we're going to help First Tee of Greater Sacramento fund some programming, so there's great coaches and programs available for the children in that community.
I think the notion of bringing the game to the community is really, really remarkable. So I applaud you on that. And along the way, You know, it's interesting how one of the best fundraising activities that that this Northern California area has going for it had very, very humble beginnings when your dad was at Hagen Oaks in his 50th year. And I remember your family asking dad, what do you want to do to kind of commemorate that? And he said, well, I don't know, why don't we have a golf tournament and invite Vince Gill? And that has developed into Golf and Guitars with a partnership with KNCI, sister station of Sacktown Sports here. And I don't know, it's 15th year or something now. And you talk about all the money it's raised and all the joy it's brought to Sacramento. That, tell us a little bit about that coming up soon.
Yeah, and it's funny, Frank. You know, I remember that first year when my dad said that, and then, you know, my brother Ken Jr., and he, you know, got this vision. And, you know, if I'm being honest, I thought he was a little bit crazy that first year of what he was thinking about. And, but as it turned out, I remember telling him, you know, congratulations, because I didn't see what it would become. And he's really turned it into such an amazing event and something great for the community. And, you know, certainly we've raised, you know, well over $1 million since the start of it to give back to charities. And so, yeah, I mean, it's basically like a pro-am with country music artists. And so we over the years, as you've seen, there's been some amazing artists go through that are now absolute superstars, you know, the Chris Youngs of the world, and, you know, on and on and on and on with different groups, Old Dominion. And it's just so much fun for the community to play golf with them. And the artists are so kind and generous. And then we get to listen to them play music afterward. It's about as good as it gets.
You know, I, it's interesting. You've kind of melded your lives together, or you know, your roles in life together, because I know you play in that tournament, and I've seen you kind of giving lessons to some of those country music stars as well, because in many cases, they've never even picked up a golf club in their lives, and, right. And they're out there sometimes playing in cowboy boots, but it's a good time for everybody.
It is. And it's funny, over the years, many of the artists, even as they've become, you know, superstars, still connect with us and ask about the event, and are now tell us that they are playing golf much more regularly. And that's where they got started, was right here.
And again, it's a fundraiser, but this is another really it's another growth of the game initiative that your dad has come up with. And in the 64 years he was at Hagen Oaks, that certainly was his life, growing the game. And to see what this has developed into, what the California Eagles has developed into, what First Tee has developed into. I mean, it's remarkable that we had a man like Ken Morton Sr. Running the golf program here in Sacramento, and really Northern California, and actually with a worldwide reputation when it comes right down to it.
Yeah, it's really incredible. And he's set such a great foundation for us. And, you know, our job really is both of the facility itself, but certainly many things he's done, is just to be the stewards of it and, you know, continue to improve upon it the best we can. And, you know, I'm very proud of all that he's done, and that I think we're, you know, taking the mantle and have continued to move it forward. And, you know, that's really all you can ask for at the end of the day. This Hagen Oaks facility especially is, you know, it's in such the heart of the community, and we just really are doing what we can to just move it forward every day, so that people can, from all walks of life, from all areas of the community, can come and enjoy it.
Scott, as you said so many times before, it's remarkable what we have here in right here in Sacramento, that people around the country are well aware of, and many of our local golfers don't realize what they have right here in their own backyard.
It's truly amazing. And, you know, one of the events I love so much that's coming up here is the putting party that's going to be raising money next week. And I can't wait for that, but I'm a little intimidated because, Tom, I saw you're participating in that as well. So now I've got to try and beat you putting also. Is that right?
Yeah, well, that's the, you know, that's one part of the game, certainly, or you probably have the best chance at. I would say that's the, you know, stuff where I'm either hot or cold. And, but yeah, no, it's such a great event. And, you know, the beauty of that event that we found is it's something truly anyone can do, right? Anyone can hop on the green and putt. And so we see different companies and different groups that bring many of their employees that don't actually quote unquote play golf, but they just love the event because they get out there and have a great time, and it doesn't last, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours like a traditional golf tournament does.
No, you're right about that, because we brought 5 what I would consider golfers to the event, and we got beat by 5 non-golfers who are in our industry pretty badly. And we were embarrassed. We had a great time, but we were certainly embarrassed after our 18 holes.
Bonneville can seek revenge next week.
The right. Weapons of grass destruction is ready to come back.
Tom Morton, Director of Coaching and Development at the Hagen Oaks Golf Complex. As always, thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate your insights and your teaching, and look forward to having you back soon. This is the Golf to Go Radio Hour, Sactown Sports, 1140.
It's the Golf to Go Hour with Frank LaRosa on Sactown Sports.
You're listening to the Golf to Go Radio Hour here on Sactown Sports, 1140. I'm Frank LaRosa. He's Scott Marsh, and we have a guest that's been with us before. Jim Cowan is the Chief Governance Officer with the Northern California Golf Association. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Hey, you know, that's a pretty big title and sounds all encompassing. First of all, what does a Chief Governance Officer do?
Well, it's kind of a new term in golf administration. For years, I was Director of Course Rating and Handicapping, and governance does still include course rating and handicapping, but also spells out to rules education and amateur status. So it's, again, a new term to golf administration, but the majority of my work still focuses on course rating and handicapping.
You know, for years, I would see your name, you know, through NCGA mailings or things like that, that Jim Cowan was out at this course, rating this course, and so on and so forth. And I used to think, wow, that's got to be one of the greatest jobs in the world, rating a golf course. And not unlike people that say, gee, you're a golf writer, all you do is play golf. My guess is that when you're playing a golf course to rate it, it's not the same as playing a golf course to enjoy the experience. Is that true?
Yeah, we break up the day into two halves. In the first half, we're actually not playing any golf. We are doing our bookwork. We're going out and we're examining and measuring landing zones. How wide is the fairway? Are there any fairway bunkers near here? What's the lie like for the next shot? How far away is out of bounds? How close are the trees and how penal are they? And we gradually work our way to the green. We're rating for both a scratch golfer and a bogey golfer. And we have criteria on them for both genders, how far they hit it, how straight they hit it. So we go through a progression on each hole, work our way to the greens. And once we get greenside, evaluate the difficulty of the bunkers, the speed of the green, the difficulty of the putting surface. And then we add up all of our numbers and then have lunch. And then afterwards, we get to go out and play. And so we get feedback on some of the numbers. Sometimes after we play, we go, wow, this green has a lot more action than I thought, or this rough has a lot more bite than I thought that it did. We may need to adjust some of our numbers. I tell you, though, rating courses, it's always comes in handy at a high school reunion when I run into someone who asks what I do for a living. So it's a nice line.
Yeah, that's great. I was intrigued with an article you wrote in the latest or recent issue of the NCGA Golf Magazine. It was called Shorter Tees Equals More Fun. And I've always been a proponent of having people move up. But for those that might want to argue a little bit, why is it going to be more fun if I play from a shorter tee?
Well, in theory, you're going to hit more greens in regulation, an occasional chance for a birdie, a par. The pace of play is going to be faster, which is certainly a deterrent to the game. So I just think, you know, for years we'd hear from people who would say, as I've gotten older, I don't hit it as far. I can't reach the corner on this dog leg. And my second shot, I'm just basically pitching it around. So, you know, you just find a set of tees that matches your game the best. And to me, that's going to enhance your enjoyment. I personally look at it, you know, if it's a great set of tees for me, if I can use almost every club in the bag, you know, there's some variety in approach shot lengths, et cetera. But, you know, hitting a green in regulation is a nice thing. reaching a fairway is a nice thing. If you're playing the set of tees that are too far, maybe that's not even possible, and that can't be any fun. So it's taken a long time for it to really catch on. There are a lot of stigmas against men moving forward. A lot of courses have changed their tee colors so that a man wouldn't have to play from the dreaded red tees. But it's really caught on in recent years, and California in general, I think, has been ahead of the curve as far as the rest of the country is concerned, and the United States has certainly been ahead of the curve as far as the world is concerned.
You know, Tom Martin was telling us a moment ago about a student of his that, you know, was having trouble, and he suggested he move up a tee, and his enjoyment went up, and Tom caught up with him later, and he said, no, I'm not doing it anymore. And he asked why, and he said, well, because I'm the only one in my group that plays from a different tee. So there's the notion of socialization, and if you're the only one in the group playing from a shorter tee, it's not that you're not having fun, but you're not, you know, enjoying the conversation, or you're missing the conversation. How do you reconcile that, or what kind of advice would you give to someone there?
Well, that's been a challenge, and a significant challenge over the years. When we come out and raid a golf course, we would see that oftentimes they weren't being used. But finally, somebody breaks the ice, and finally, somebody invites someone else to come up. That breaks the ice, and the next thing you know, you have more people playing from there. We've seen it with our own raiders. We have a group of 60-something volunteer raiders, men and women. The average age on the men's side is probably approaching 70, some older, and we've seen them gradually move up, and before they couldn't convince anyone, but now we see a regular group of them asking to be paired together and intentionally moving up there. So I think you need an icebreaker and, you know, a little coaxing, hey, I reached this green in regulation, or hey, I made a birdie last week, why don't you just give it a go? I know of one course that brought out, developed some new tees, and they actually specifically ran a tournament where everyone, including the really good players, played from those short tees one time just to introduce those tees. It gave even the very good players a different perspective of the golf course and what club they might hit off the tee and where they might hit it. But that was a nice way to introduce these new tees and maybe convince some people that it's time to move forward.
You know, I think that when you talk about the enjoyment and the satisfaction of hitting greens and so forth, I mean, much of the teaching theory at this point suggests that you start them closer to the green, you know, especially with juniors. They start with a 50-yard tee or the 25-yard tee, and they move back as they are able to play the game from those tees. But if we learn the game that way, the notion of you know, hitting a short iron as opposed to a three wood on every par four would make the game much more interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a great way to look at it, a great way to introduce the game. And let's face it, a large percentage of the strokes in a typical round are played from near the green anyway. You know, we got a PGA tournament going on. We have the tournament at Harding Park with the women's teams playing. And again, a huge percentage of those strokes are going to be played from on and near the green. So starting there is probably a really good idea from that standpoint, too.
I know, Scott, when you and I play, you know, you certainly hit your tee shot and your irons are a lot crisper. So, you know, you like to play back a little bit. And most of the time I'll play with you. But, you know, until we get around the green, as Jim suggests, you know, I'm kind of trying to catch up with you. But we also play with another friend that plays from the shorter tees all the time. And it really has never slowed us down. I mean, we're all aware that we're playing a different tee, and the game keeps moving.
It's really a non-issue, quite honestly. You know, I think within a group, you can figure it out. I do think there is some socialization based on the group that you're with. You don't want to be the lone person if you don't know the other three as well in terms of playing a different tee. Jim, my question for you is a little bit more weather related. When you come up with these, you know, slopes and everything else, and then when you're putting in a score, you know, How does it factor? I'm just curious if, like, let's say on the individual day that you're playing, of course, there's a 20 mile an hour wind or there's really inclement weather versus a perfect day. How does that all kind of figure out into a scoring index, or does it at all?
Yes, there is an adjustment, and that was due to the development of the World Handicap System. There were a lot of countries, and you think of Scotland as a really good example, where the wind could be blowing much more than 20 miles an hour. They had an adjustment within their handicap systems that could account for that. And so part of the World Handicap System, they tried to select the best parts from several of the other handicap systems across the world, and that's one that was incorporated. So as far as that specific subject is concerned, at the end of the day, when the scores get processed, basically at midnight, an analysis is run. It knows all the scores that have been posted that day. It knows the handicaps of those people who posted those scores. And in theory, there's a range of expected scores that a 10 handicapper is going to shoot, that a 20 handicapper is going to shoot, et cetera. And so it examines all the scores and accounts the number of scores that were returned that day that were within the expected range, and then it counts the outliers, and it looks to see whether the outliers were on the low side or the high side. And if they were on the high side and you had a much greater percentage of scores that were outliers on the high side, an adjustment will kick in. It'll say something was going on, either weather related or course setup related, that was causing the scores to be much higher that day, and an adjustment would kick in. So a score of 80 on a particularly tough day might be considered a slightly better round than an 80 on that very same golf course on a day where there weren't any of those conditions. And it can work the other way. If on the weekend a course moved all their tees up and went with vanilla hole locations, maybe the scores happen to be low. And so there is an adjustment that looks at that. When we rate, though, we rate for July 1st conditions. So we're rating for, there are some courses that are going to have a wind factor and everything in the wind because of the delta impact. So we rate for midsummer conditions. We don't rate for extremes in weathers. And that's been a challenge the last couple of years, rating because of an epic drought, having to ask someone, hey, that empty pond there on a normal July, would there be water in that pond? And they'd say yes. We'd have to tell the team, okay, act as though that pond is filled to the brim. And then this year, early in the season, we're just seeing all sorts of long lost ball rough that's sprouted up that normally wouldn't be there. So we're having to ask the clubs, and on July 1st, would you have that patch of lost ball rough over there to the right of the fourth hole or whatever? And because we're not trying to rate for the conditions we experienced that day, we're trying to rate for normal conditions when most rounds are posted.
Pretty incredible process rating a golf course. And this is Jim Cowan, the chief governance officer from the NCGA. And Jim is saying from a shorter tee, you're going to have more fun. I tend to agree with him. Jim, thanks for spending some time with us today on the Golf to Go Radio Hour. Appreciate all you have, and would like to have you back at some point.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Thanks to all my guests today, Jason Scott Deegan, Tom Morton, and Jim Cowan. This is the Golf to Go Radio Hour on Sactown Sports 1140. Look for us next week.